And we're back here on Unusual Sources, 93.3 CFMU FM, bringing you the news you don't ordinarily get to hear. We'll certainly be doing that today because we have Ottawa-based writer, activist, commentator Stephen Gowans with us. Again, we're calling him directly in Ottawa. He released an article a few days ago, I think it was on the 20th, about the sinking of that South Korean corvette and the controversy that surrounded that, as well as the intensifying international situation. Stephen, are you with us on the phone here?
I am. Hello.
Hi. You're coming in loud and clear. That's great. Well, I wanted to thank you for coming with us because, in particular, you seem to be the only person that I'm familiar with who is presenting an opposing view on this whole subject. And it's the purpose of our program to get news out to our listeners that they're not getting to hear. And you've been able to bring us that kind of commentary and analysis. When we look at the situation with the sinking here, it's really dangerous because of its potential to escalate. It's already escalated from where it was 2 months ago. This is a situation that could even lead to a war between North Korea and South Korea that other countries might be involved in, and that would be an awful situation. It would be a worst-case scenario. So when we look at what's being used as a casus belli or a justification to further intensify the situation, we want to be really careful to closely examine all the evidence to make sure we're not being sold a bill of goods. And in your case, you've suggested that the sinking of this ship is being treated like another Gulf of Tonkin incident, which is being used to wave red flags, get people all excited for a war that doesn't need to happen. I guess we can start with the sinking of this corvette. It's really interesting the work you've done into this because you've been looking at the South Korean media and reproducing some of their reports. And as far as I can tell, and stop me if I'm wrong here, but it seems that South Korean intelligence director, what he was initially saying has contradicted the reports we're getting now. First, he said that there wasn't really any evidence that it was a North Korean attack, that, in fact, the sinking might be an accident, that they didn't even really detect any unusual activities in the area. What was the South Korean intelligence saying at the time that this started to unfold?
Well, you're right. That's exactly what they said. When I read that the South Korean government was going to release the findings of its inquiry into the sinking, I immediately went back to the articles that appeared soon after the actual event, because the sinking happened in March, and we didn't get the findings of the inquiry until May. So I went back to late March, early April, and I started reading what was said at the time the sinking happened. And the director of South Korea's National Intelligence told a South Korean parliamentary committee that there was absolutely no evidence linking North Korea to the sinking. And then the defense minister backed him up, and he said that the crew of the ship had not detected a torpedo, because at the time, the conservative elements in South Korea, when they discovered that this ship had been sunk, immediately started pointing their fingers at the North and saying it must have been a North Korean submarine. So initially, members of the military and the defense minister were denying that, were saying that their evidence was that there was no North Korean involvement. They said that members of the warship had not detected a torpedo. They said that they closely monitored the waters, well, in fact, all waters around South Korea, and they detected no North Korean vessels in the vicinity. They said they monitored North Korean submarines and North Korean semi-submersibles, and none had been detected, which I found really interesting because the story then started to change over time. You had South Korean military officials saying, you know, there's no evidence that North Korea is involved, but members of the Grand National Party, or the ruling party, immediately saying, we believe it must be North Korea. In fact, the president of South Korea said his intuition told him that it was North Korea. So over time, the story evolves, and then we have the release of the findings from the inquiry that, lo and behold, tells us exactly what it was that the South Korean president's intuition had told him.
Yes, and I believe it was in this inquiry, at this point, it had become international. The United States had been involved in this inquiry. I believe, in fact, they call this an international inquiry, right? Except this is sort of like the way they use the word international community, where it means like the United States, Australia, Great Britain, Canada, Sweden. And who was on the international body that did this later investigation?
Right. Well, I mean, the Axis was international, too. And I suppose if the Axis had struck a committee to inquire into something that had been done by allied countries, it would have been pretty clear that the conclusion was foreordained, so that it's international means very little. I mean, the members of the committee were representatives of countries that are allies of South Korea and are hostile to North Korea.
Well, let's be honest about that. I mean, this committee was basically South Korea and the United States with a few countries they sort of threw in there, as far as I can tell. I mean, there's some countries that were involved. I think Britain might have been involved, but basically this is U.S., South Korea, and France. It's not like they took, as you said, the Third World Movement or you know, a bunch of random countries from the United Nations to do this. This was South Korea's NATO-type military allies.
That's correct, yep.
Now,
the usual international community.
Okay, so we know that it's going to be biased, as you said, and the conclusion might be kind of preordained, but let's look at it. Okay, for the first few months of this, they're saying, you know, we don't really think it's the North Koreans. We don't think that there was a torpedo. We don't think, you know, it could have been an accident. We don't really know what happened at this point. And then, you know, the United States gets in there, and all of a sudden the story changes, and it was a North Korean submarine that penetrated there and shot it with a torpedo. Okay, all right, well, let's investigate that claim. This is South Korea, and there's a demilitarized zone between South Korea and North Korea on the land, and in the water, these waters are heavily patrolled, because what they don't want is North Korean submarines coming into South Korea and doing things. So there's a lot of ships, not just South Korean, but at that time, I believe, near March 18, there's also a major international military exercise. So there was South Korean ships, there was, I believe, United States vessels, there was a lot of ships in those waters, but whatever the case may be, there was a lot of high-tech ships and certainly able to patrol the border and guard against any intrusion at the time. Now, this is what gets me. Those waters that the ship sunk in, they were pretty shallow, right? What was the depth?
I'm not sure of the depth, but one of the things I found in my review of the South Korean newspapers was the former South Korean Navy chief of staff saying, you know, and this is direct quote, "Some people are pointing the finger at North Korea, but anyone with knowledge about the waters where the shipwreck occurred would not draw that conclusion so easily." And he went on to point out that the waters are very shallow and they're fast moving, which means that it'd be very difficult for a submarine to operate in waters of that nature.
Right. And they're saying that it was probably, if it was a North Korean submarine, then it would be like one of those midget submarines, right? Like a very small submarine. It would have had to been a small submarine. It would have been slow, probably. It would have had poor navigational ability. You wouldn't be able to cram any sensors or anything onto that thing. And coming from North Korea, this ship, this little submarine, would have had to navigate there, go through this shallow area. It would have had to locate that South Korean ship, identify it, and then it would have to, you know, shoot a torpedo at it at I don't know how many kilometers away, hit it dead on, and then escape. Escape all that ship, escape all the other pickets and aircraft that could be looking for it. You know, it seems to be, you're asking a lot from the North Korean military and the North Korean Navy to sneak a tiny submarine into heavily guarded South Korean waters, attack and destroy a ship, and withdraw in the face of other Navy vessels and so forth. But that's what they're telling us. So I guess the other part is the torpedo, right? Because now they've come up with the torpedo and they say this is a North Korean torpedo. What's your view on that?
Well, a North Korean torpedo. So, I mean, there are torpedo fragments found. But where do they come from? I mean, there are a number of possibilities. They could be torpedo fragments from another country. They could be torpedo fragments from North Korea that are unrelated to the sinking of the ship. Or they could have been torpedo fragments that are related to the sinking of the ship. But there are a number of possibilities. And it doesn't follow necessarily that because someone has collected some fragments of a torpedo that there's a connection, therefore, between the sinking of the ship and North Korea.
Yeah, those are pretty big fragments, by the way. I mean, we're being asked to take the word of the United States and South Korea on this because they're the people that have produced that evidence, and they're the people that have analyzed that evidence. And I guess that's where we get into the politics of this, because, as you say, you've been referring to a lot of South Korean accounts, and there's a lot of people in South Korea that were skeptical and weren't buying this from the very beginning, didn't really think it was a North Korean sub. So I understand you've made reference to the ruling party in South Korea, and the president, I understand, he's a very conservative fellow, and he has been pushing for more aggressive action toward North Korea, trying to basically, you know, force it to collapse. He's been in favor of cutting aid and things like that. Wasn't that one of his first actions, I think? So this is someone who has an agenda. The way that, you know, his party and his policy and his platform for getting elected, getting votes, is to be hard on North Korea. Now, there's other voices in South Korea as well. Can you tell us more about this dynamic?
Well, right. I mean, that's exactly why one needs to be skeptical about the, and that's exactly why there are people in South Korea who are skeptical about the claims. The opposition parties are skeptical and say that the findings of the inquiry are untrustworthy. There are a number of civil groups who say the same. And the reason they say that is, first, because there are elections that are due to be held in early June. These are elections for mayor and governor. And traditionally, the Conservative Party, the Grand National Party, has invoked the idea of the Red Scare to be able to muster support in elections. So the opposition parties say there's an interesting coincidence here. We're about to have an election, and suddenly you start pointing to the dangers of North Korea. The second thing is, yes, Lee, the president, has departed from the policies of his two predecessors. And his two predecessors' policies were to seek a kind of peaceful coexistence on the Korean Peninsula and to bring the two countries closer together, perhaps ultimately in a confederation. But Lee's orientation is quite different. To quote Selig Harrison, who's kind of the top liberal U.S. establishment expert on Korea, he says, South Korea is once again seeking the collapse of the North and its absorption by the South. That's the leitmotif of his foreign policy, which is to bring down North Korea. And so in order to marshal support, public support for that kind of policy and for a departure from, you know, the more peaceful reunification policies of his predecessors, it's useful for him to have an incident to point to, such as this apparent or supposed unprovoked aggression by North Korea.
Right, and that on its own is interesting, because why would North Korea want to do this? What motivation do they have to sneak into South Korea and sink a ship and then sneak away? What do they gain from doing that?
Well, exactly. And one of the truest things that has been said about this comes from the U.S. State Department yesterday, or today. Now the news is, or the news that you see in the New York Times and other newspapers about North Korea severing relations with South Korea, as if this was an idea that originated with North Korea and wasn't a reaction to the South Korea decision to kind of sever relations with the North. But in connection with that, the State Department said, we can't imagine why it is that the North would try to sever its connection with the South, since the South has such a dynamic economy, which is exactly true. So you can ask yourself, why would the North deliberately provoke the South? Why would it attack the South? And then, having attacked, why would it vehemently deny that it has done so?
Right.
This doesn't benefit North Korea one iota.
I think some people were trying to theorize it, you know, come up with explanations why North Korea would do it, and they would say things like, well, they had a naval battle with South Korea and they wanted to get them back for their pride, you know. And if that was true, then why aren't they bragging about it? If it would make them feel good to do that, why aren't they just saying, yeah, we got that ship, but they don't think they were involved at all. They don't take credit for it. So it is hard to see their motivation. When you look at who benefits, well, you've suggested there's a few people who do benefit from saying that this is a North Korean attack. One of them is the South Korean right wing, as you've mentioned, and the current president. It helps his election campaign. He comes back in power. They get to enforce their agenda of cracking down on North Korea rather than greater efforts towards peaceful unification. So there's that dynamic within South Korea. You've suggested U.S. arms manufacturers benefit because ever since this came out, they've been saying, well, if a North Korean sub attacked, then you guys need better sonar, you need to buy new weapons, you need new ships, you need new equipment, so they can make billions selling this equipment. And the other issue relates to Japan because it sort of provides justification for the United States to maintain troops on Japanese soil. And it's not me who's saying this. This was Hillary Clinton, right? Hillary Clinton came out and said, you know, it reinforces the importance of having U.S. presence, you know, in Japan, and they get to remain in South Korea as well. This helps their cause of staying put with their troops.
Mm-hmm.
And that's interesting because their troops never leave. And I understand sentiment is rising in Japan against this. There's been some significant opposition to the presence of U.S. military bases. Now, Japan is related to this conflict as well. They could be drawn into if any such conflict. And it relates to their politics because the new government in Japan, the one that was elected recently, was supposed to be more independent, I understand. It was supposed to be more nationalist. And they were asserting their right to Japanese soil, that you wouldn't need to have a U.S. base in Okinawa. And I believe the government had initially been campaigning or proposing on that basis that the U.S. presence be removed. But they've since backed away from that. It seems that in terms of the elected government in Japan, that they've been moving away from their nationalist agenda. Do you see that continuing in the case of this incident?
Well, they had to move away. I mean, that was one of the policies they put forward in the election, and presumably one of the mandates they had was to move the base, the U.S. base, off Okinawa. And they intended to do that, the new government, but the United States resisted and said, well, I don't care what you intend. We're sticking there. And so eventually the government realized that they couldn't do anything. It wasn't going to expel the U.S., and the U.S. wasn't going to move. So it kind of had to backtrack, which is embarrassing. But now this incident happens, and it's proved very useful for the Japanese government because now it can say, well, look, we have to keep U.S. troops in Okinawa because look at the danger posed by North Korea. And the idea that North Korea poses a danger to South Korea or to Japan is absurd in the extreme. I mean, you look at military expenditures. I mean, North Korea spends $7 billion a year on its military. South Korea spends $20 billion and is about to spend even more. South Korea has a fairly substantial military. The United States has over 30,000 U.S. troops on South Korean soil. It has 60,000 troops in Japan nearby. So, I mean, we're talking about a pipsqueak in North Korea against this formidable military. But you have to keep making the pipsqueak appear to be more formidable and frightening than it actually is.
Well,
to serve domestic policies in Japan and South Korea and U.S. foreign policy.
Yeah, and we've talked about the right wing in South Korea, the current ruling government. What have you been able to read about the left or any of the opposition in terms of their views on this conflict?
Well, they're highly skeptical, and they say that the findings of the inquiry are untrustworthy. If you read in you know, North American newspapers, you'd think that everyone in the world believes the findings of the inquiry and that no one's skeptical, but that's not the case. Certainly people in South Korea are skeptical. Not everyone is. I think the latest poll suggests about a 70% of South Koreans believe the findings of the inquiry, but the official opposition parties are highly skeptical, and for good reason.
Now, finally, I mean, it looks like we're getting into this. Canada. I just read the other day, looks like Canada is talking about putting sanctions on North Korea. Do we really have to stick our nose into this? Is this Stephen Harper coming to the aid of a friend in South Korea, another Stephen Harper type who's the president there? We already are involved in Afghanistan across the world, and it's an unpopular war, and it's not going so well. Why is Canada so eager to jump into this conflict, which has the potential of becoming much larger?
Well, I think because from Stephen Harper's perspective, there's no downside. And there's no downside. I mean, I think the sanctions are the termination of any kind of trade with North Korea, and I don't believe there's very much of that anyway. So no one really is harmed, neither side, actually. And then, you know, Harper can look like, I don't know, whatever it is that he wants to look like. Hard on the evil North Koreans or whatever it is.
I hope people don't get carried away by the flag wave being in the fist shaking. We wouldn't want to be misled into yet another war. Escalation of that type would not be in the benefit of a whole lot of people. So, yeah, thanks for bringing this to our attention, and thanks for posting about this, writing about this, and giving that oppositional view. In the English language, in the Western Hemisphere, there's not a whole lot of critical analysis going on, but you're one of the people that have gone and made the effort to do so, and that's why we appreciate that, and that's why we have you on the program today. So, again, thanks very much, Stephen, for making the time to do this and to share with us what you've been able to glean from reading the South Korean and other press on this particular issue.
Well, thanks for having me.